History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold. If we're willing to just do a couple really simple things that are becoming a bit of a lost art in today's world, ask a few questions and take a little time to listen. It's amazing how much that can add to our perspective. Our goal here is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, we're educated, yes, but we're also entertained. And most importantly, we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This weekend marks the 83rd anniversary of the Day of Infamy, December 7th, 1941, when Imperial Japan's surprise attack on American military installations on the island of Oahu shocked the world, claimed more than 2,400 American lives, and ultimately launched the U.S. into nearly 4 years of war. Today, you're going to hear memories from five different men who were there 83 years ago, starting with a pilot who was flying his B-17 into Pearl Harbor that Sunday morning after flying all night from Northern California. These are the memories of Robert Thacker.
We had been up all night for two nights, no sleep. You're young, and you think you can have anything and do anything. So we really weren't concerned. And all of a sudden, here's this big hole in the clouds. I look straight down, Diamond Head. My navigator had flew 2,500 miles and wasn't off 1 mile by shooting three-star fixes all night long. Hobdy, great guy, great navigator. So I let down through the hole, flying along. My radio operator had been there before, and he said, there's Doris Duke's home. We're blah, 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 blah. And I saw these scratches in the sky, and I said, what are those? And he said, that's volcanic action. And there's the Royal Hawaiian. And I said, blah, 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 on the horn. No answer from the tower. No answer from me. This is 8 o'clock in the morning, and you know when the attack started. When? 8 o'clock. So I said, hell, I can see. I said, where is Hickam? He said, you see that big white tower there? That's Hickam, and that's the Pearl Harbor. So I said, what's that great big column of black smoke that just went up? He said, they're burning off the cane fields. Well, that was the Arizona going up. And I said, blah, 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 noise. Come up here and give me a new frequency. I can't get anybody. So, I can see the runway. I can see that big black smoke and see which way the wind is blowing. I'll land this thing because we're out of fuel. We're exhausted. We've been up all night, two nights in a row. So I cracked about half flaps and dropped the gear and started over Ford Island. All of a sudden, a tower came on and said, number Air Force 432, you're number two to land, land north to south. We're under attack by Japanese aircraft. And exactly that, bang, 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 all over the place. The Navy was shooting at me. Well, I was right over Ford Island, and everything was on fire, and anything that was airborne that morning, you know, was what? It was the Jap. And I've been criticized by calling the Jap, but in those days, you used the word Jap. Now it's Japanese, which is fine with. But I said, my God, I'm going to get out of here. So I chopped the throttles, broke out of traffic to the right, landed crosswind. There were three zeros jumped me, and he shot the right gear out. I ground looped on the end of the runway and took a look around, and I said, I think we better just redirect here. All I needed was a tire and bombs and fuel, and I could go. And I started towards the flight line, and I said, no, I think this is a mistake. let's go between Hickam and the commercial air drop. In those days, it was nothing but a big swamp. So we went over to the swamps, and that's the best idea I ever had, because right then, these 13 in a nice V-level Japanese bombers came over Hickam, and they just wiped out the flight line, killed a couple of friends of mine on the flight line. And if we'd have been over there, we wouldn't be here talking to you.
That was Robert Thacker, and while he was attempting to land at Hickam Field, Ed Hall was already on the ground there.
And then I heard the darndest explosion you'd ever want to hear in your life. Now I thought something blew up outside. I ran to the back door, looked up Hangar Avenue. Hangar 7 and 9 had blown up and debris was flying everywhere. And I thought, my God, an airplane exploded in one of the hangars? And then about that time, Hangar 2 and 4 was right across the street from me. The entrance was in line with the door where I was standing. Guys were running out of the hangar, scattering all over everywhere. And then I saw puffs of asphalt kicking up. What the hey? And then I saw this plane coming across the runway the wrong way. Holy mackerel, who's this idiot? And then I realized that's gunfire. And this plane is coming right at me. And this guy is so low, he couldn't have been more than 25, 30 feet off the ground. But he had to pull up to miss the building and the electrical wires that were outside. That's what saved my life, because he was coming straight at me. As he flew over, I looked up. He was looking down at me, and I was looking up at him, and he had a big smile on his face. I mean, that's how close he was. And I could see him. So then I went running out, hollering for Alex, where is everybody? Well, they had all disappeared. Oh, I got to tell you one other. As I turned around, before I could yell at Alex, I decided, I got to hide someplace. Where, oh, the kitchen sink. So I dived under the kitchen sink. And things seemed to quiet down just for a second or so, and that's when I got out. Started yelling for Alex, and I ran outside, and now I'm still in awe. I'm staring out in the air, looking at all these planes flying around. And one guy reaches out from under the eave of a building, grabs me by the shoulder, curses me out, you're going to get killed, get under here. And I didn't more than get under the eave of that building. Here comes another plane strafing, took off about 2 inches of that edge of that building, number two.
Second time your life was saved.
Second time. So now this is the hick with the mess hall. I got to get down to the motor pool because I know they're going to need drivers. So I go down there, and I was told to take a truck and go up Hangar Avenue and do whatever I could to help out. Well, it always, even to this day, it seems a mystery to me how this happened. But as I got up near the hangars, it had exploded, which was right across the street was the big barracks. And the guy come running out, waving his hands, stop, stop, I need you, I need you. I said, who are you? He said, I'm a medic, we got wounded. We got to get him to the hospital. So that's what I did for the rest of the day. And then we took a load over to the hospital, came back over on Hangar Avenue, and went in between the hangars, picking up wounded. I picked up one dead lieutenant, and he had a .45 automatic. Well, his guts are spilled all over it. He don't need it. So I took his .45 and never cleaned that belt either. It still had blood on it the day I had to turn it in when I came back to the States. But I believe it was the second or could have been the third trip that we made. We got strafed again. The tires were shot out on the truck, and we had bullets come between him and myself through the cab. They just missed both of us. Actually, we didn't realize that until we stopped and picked up another wounded. Well, we stopped when the tires went flat. Not to pick up a wounded, really, but there was wounded there. And as he got out and went to shut the door, he says, my God, Ed, look at the holes in the roof. I looked at him, my Lord, where the... And then I realized the tires had been shot out and these dang gun bullets came through the roof of the cab. Number three. Well, that was my three close calls for the day. So the rest of the next 2 or 3 hours, we were still roaming around looking for wounded. I couldn't tell you how many people we picked up that were wounded.
Are we talking like dozens?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, at least. And I believe I have, I just knew these fellows. I can't say they were friends, but they were acquaintances. Leonard Beasley, Eugene Denson, and Robert Kelly. Now, Robert Kelly I knew real well. They were killed that day, those three. All three of them belonged to the 42nd Bomb Squadron.
Ed Hall, remembering three of the 189 airmen killed at Hickam Field on December 7, 1941. Members of every branch of service were involved on that day of infamy. Francisco Paredes was in the Army, assigned to Schofield Barracks.
I was on my way to church for Mass, and all of a sudden I heard a big noise, and the sirens went off, and they says, "This is not a drill. This is not a drill. All personnel report to your stations." I didn't have a station, but we did have machine guns set up, you know. So what I did, I manned the first machine gun that I could find, and it was a Twin 50 on a Heinz mount. I spotted this torpedo bomber. He was probably about maybe 150, 200 feet up in the air. I could see the pilot, and I took a burst at him, and I missed him. Then I gave him a lead. And then I took another burst at him, and I smoked him. I don't know whether he went down, but I'm pretty sure he did went down because he started going towards the ocean. So that's where everything went haywire. So I start picking up, fighting fires, helping out, you know, with whatever I did. And I helped for about maybe 7 or 8 days. I start pulling bodies, limbs, you know, arms, legs, you know, and heads, and it was awful. Thinking about it, you know, it makes me cry. The poor people, innocent people that got caught in a turmoil like that.
One of those people was a sailor from Nebraska named Don Stratton. He was aboard the USS Arizona.
My battle station was a sight setter in the port and the aircraft guns on the port side, and that was up about 55, 60 feet in the air on the tripod mast on the foremost.
And people hear you say that, and maybe some of them have already read your book, All the Gallant Men, or they've seen one of your interviews or heard you before. But when people imagine that morning and they think about you being in that position, that many feet in the air with these Japanese planes coming in and bombs dropping, I'm sure they say, how in the world did you survive? You ever wonder that yourself?
Well, it had to be a lot of to do with the good Lord, I guess, and but we were kind of trapped up there. We got out of the director and on the deck there, and the vessel was alongside a repair ship, and we got a hold of a seaman there that threw us a heaving line that's a line with a lead on the end to stretch it out, and a small line, and then he added a big, heavier line, and we pulled that across, and we tied it off on the Arizona, and we started hand over hand across it, and we were already burnt. I was burned like over 60% of my body, I guess, at that time.
How did that occur? You were in that position on the foremast when the big explosion happened?
The bomb that hit on the starboard side behind number 2 turret went into a million pounds of ammunition, and it blew up. It just was a fireball that just engulfed us up there where we were at, and no way to escape or get off. So until we got the line there to go hand over hand across, we're kind of just stymied up there, and we finally got off. 6 of us went across there.
But I'm just trying to imagine what those moments were like when you're engulfed in flames and your flesh is burning and you're trapped and you can't go anywhere. What do you do?
You're just trying to get out away from the flames and thinking about how the hell am I going to get out of here.
So if that seaman hadn't had that idea to tie that line.
Well, we kind of indicated that we wanted to get off of there, and he throwed us a heaving line, which is a small line, and then tied on a heavier line, and it was about probably 65, 70 feet across there, and we had to go hand over hand across there.
So already you said 60%+ of your body had been burned. So is that upper body, lower body?
Well, the whole body, everything.
But your hands were okay?
My hands were burnt. I don't even have any fingerprints.
Well, was that from the explosion or was that from going down that line?
That was both.
So your hands are burnt, and then you have to hold on to a line or else you're going to fall to your death.
Right.
With hands that are already burnt and I can't imagine what that feels like, the pain that you must have been experiencing. Or did adrenaline take over?
Well, it's just self-preservation.
So you get down to that other ship, the Vestal, which is next to the Arizona. I've interviewed a couple guys who are on that ship, and they've described what your ship looked like. But once you got aboard on the Vestal, there's still a lot going on, probably. What did you see from there?
Well, we stood around there for quite a while. The Vestal was busy with firing their guns and whatever and trying to get away from the side of the Arizona and the explosion. And they finally got us in the shore boat and took us to the beach, and they picked us up in an open-air truck and took us to the hospital.
And how long were you in the hospital?
A year.
That's a long time.
That's a long time. Wasn't quite that long. It was like till the next September.
And I'm sure, well, I've read some of your story. I don't want to put words in your mouth. I want to understand how you experienced it. So very few people alive experienced what you experienced. You're in all this pain, and you know you're going to recover. But was it a daily basis in those days that followed that you were learning of other guys that you knew from the ship who didn't make it?
Well, we most certainly figured that, but there was a few ex-sailors in the hospital with us and everything, so but we knew we'd suffered a devastating hit and a lot of casualties, but it took a lot of baths, saltwater baths, and a lot of healing and a lot of patience.
Where did that come from? You're a pretty young guy. You haven't been through a whole lot until this.
Well, you do what you have to do.
Did your parents know you were alive, or did that take a while?
No, they got a notice that I didn't make it, and then they got a notice that I did. But they sent us back to Mare Island Hospital and went through a lot of baths, a lot of skin grafts, a lot of time laying. They put us on a bunk and put a canopy over the top of us and covered the canopy with a blanket and put light bulbs in the canopy to keep us warm. Kept the burns open to the healing air. I wanted to go back into the Navy, so I went back after I was home for about a year, and my whole left side healed up really much from the medical discharge. So I re-enlisted and went back in, and they put me on I went to boot camp again because it hadn't caught up on my shots and stuff, and I went to island there in the bay, and they put me aboard a destroyer, DD-406 USS Stack. We headed for the South Pacific right away, and we were in on the invasion, the whole land in New Guinea and a couple of islands offshore there. And we went to Guadalcanal, picked up troops to put in the Philippines, and the lady, and we were in the Battle of Leyte Gulf, and we were in the Battle of Luzon Gulf, and we led all the invasions in with the mine sweeps, and finally Okinawa, and we were on pickup patrol 300 miles north of Okinawa between there and Japan, and for the kamikazes coming down, and let them know down below that they were on their way, and that was kind of hazardous. We lost 5 ships one night there, and they sent me back to the States, and the war was over, and I had a game.
And I understand that you lived that, and that you've told your story many times. So that is, in a way, old hat to you. But you do understand how crazy that sounds to most people, right? That you were burned over the majority of your body. You still don't have any feeling in your fingers that you haven't had for years. You're recovering for a year in the hospital. You've been medically discharged. But you sign up to go back, and you end up fighting the rest of the war. Why? Why was that so important to you?
Well, it's just one of those things that happens, I guess. Felt like maybe I should be there, but whatever happened. But that's the way it worked.
And the title of your book is All the Gallant Men, and you're honoring those who died December 7th and really the 406,000 Americans who died in the war. But it strikes me that just that action you took, I mean, you are the gallant man. Did you feel that you were doing something beyond what was asked of you?
No, the heroes were still out there.
Still on your ship.
Yeah.
What'd your parents think when you re-enlisted?
Well, actually, they didn't want me to go, but they said if that's what you're made up your mind to do, it's your life to live. It's just the thing that surprise attacked and didn't get a chance to fight back too much, so I was still in the same predicament. I loved the Navy, and I went back in. Like I tell everybody had to be someplace, and I was there.
If you've never read Don Stratton's book, All the Gallant Men, pick it up or get it for a friend for Christmas. 2,400 American lives lost that day, every other American life forever altered on that day of infamy. Our special Pearl Harbor edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
President Franklin D. Roosevelt, 83 years ago, on December 8, 1941. We've already heard four different veterans' reflections on what happened at Pearl Harbor on December 7th. Here comes another one. Of all the Pearl Harbor survivors we've had the privilege of meeting over the years, I don't know if any of them was more passionate about keeping this history alive than Stu Henley, who was aboard the battleship USS West Virginia.
I've heard many people say Pearl Harbor was a defeat. I don't agree with them. My opinion is it was an eye-opener because the minute Nimitz took command, he followed Admiral Yamamoto's procedure. He built the battle fleet around the aircraft carrier.
Big change in strategy.
Yes. I never had a hatred, any animosity toward the Japanese. And I'll tell you why. I lived for a whole year out in Kamakee. And we had a Japanese maid, a Japanese gardener, husband and wife, and a darling little boy. And I loved them. I looked at it this way when I was manning my battle station. You know, they're doing what they're told to do, just as I'm told. Because when I went to get my hat put on my head, I thought I was going to be with a fire and fighting away fire and rescue party. And when I reached for my hat, I got kicked right in the seat of the pants by a first-class bosun mate, Hicks. Get to your battle station on the double. This is the real thing. I grabbed my hat and ran on topside. Planes are diving from every direction. And similar to this, a gun sets up off the deck. Mm-hmm. And it's all open underneath. I saw this pilot, Lieutenant White, shooting with his .45. Well, I dove under there with him. Now, I'm a seaman first class. He's a lieutenant commander, so I'm not going to question. But I'm thinking. And he says, son, where's your battle station? And I put it up to gun three. He says, get up there as fast as you can. As I was going up the ladder to get in the turret, here come a Japanese torpedo plane down the port side. I could see the pilot, the radioman, and the co-pilot laughing like everything. I got inside the turret, and Crosen was already in the trainer's seat. Nobody was up on the gun deck, no shellmen or rammers or anybody. So I went down to my battle station. When I go out to the schools, I put on a little demonstration. I point out how the Lord protected me. When I was 9 years old, I used to like to sit in the chair and lean back on the back two legs. My dad only spoke twice. Third time he acted. and you yes sir and no sir in our house. Mm-hmm. So I was in the kitchen, and I'm leaning back on the back two legs. My dad walked in. Stuart, they made four legs and a chair to sit on the floor. Yes, sir. But how quick a nine-year-old forgets. So next time I'm leaning back, my dad says, Stuart, I'll not tell you again. Yes, sir. In this ear and out that ear. So the next time I'm leaning back, my dad walked in the kitchen, kicked the bag leg out from underneath me. I cracked my head on the floor. I said, there's got to be a better way. Now you see my legs back up under. That's 9 years old, a habit that I learned. I'm now 20 years old, and I'm in my battle station. Normally, my feet would be on a platform. I would be bent over cranking in the dials for the elevation that they want that gun raised.
And this is a big 16-inch gun.
16-inch cannon.
How big are the projectiles in that?
It stands 5'2". It's 16 inches in diameter. They weigh 2,700 pounds. I called it a Volkswagen going out the barrel. And it takes five 100-pound bags of black powder to hurl that shell from San Diego to Oceanside.
Uh-huh.
That is, if I've got that gun elevated to maximum height, that shell will fly 30 miles.
I just wanted people to have a sense of this isn't a little anti-aircraft gun. This the biggest you got.
So now I'm in my battle position, but we're not going to fire these 16-inch guns in Pearl. We'll blow Pearl Harbor off the map.
Yeah.
And so consequently, my feet were back up underneath me. I'm on a high stool. No back. J.A. phones on. And we could hear the machine gun bullets hitting the turret. We felt the thud of a torpedo. And Krausen says, Stu, let's see what's going on. We took the sight cap off our periscope and bam, there went the Arizona. And I estimated there were about 32 bodies that flew through the atmosphere.
So I want people to understand what you're saying here, because very few people actually saw the Arizona
explode.
They saw the aftermath. They saw the smoke, or they heard it and they turned.
We saw it.
You looked into this viewfinder right before the bomb hit.
And see, I immediately thought that a bomb went down this stack because it looked like the ship broke in half. When I met this fellow here, I found out the truth. Jack McCarran was one that was blown off the ship into the burning oil. But he later informed me that he had been informed that an armor-piercing shell went through the starboard side of the forecastle right into number one handling room. There's 1,000 bags of black powder in each one of the handling rooms. That exploded. That set off turret two. That's what broke the ship in half.
But you're a 20-year-old kid.
I'm a 20-year-old brat growing up overnight.
And you're looking at a ship just like yours, another battleship, blowing up and bodies flying through the air.
Yep.
How do you react to that?
Startled, surprised, but waiting for the next scenario.
Sure.
Because the next scenario was an armor-piercing shell dropped from a high-level bomber came through our turret. And what he'd done, he took 15-inch armor-piercing shells. Mm-hmm. They welded fins on them so that they would spiral. Well, over top of our left gun is a catapult, and I called it a slingshot. And we had two airplanes on that catapult that morning. One was a scout observation plane, an SOU-2, and the other was the Kingfish, the Admiral's plane. Well, the scout observation is a biplane.
Yeah.
The top wing is the gas tank. The Admiral's plane is a single wing. And when that shell hit, it hit the top wing of the scout plane. The gasoline exploded, burnt the plane to a crisp, split that catapult in half, and came down through 5 inches of steel right into the left gun. And the reason I'm here today is because that shell did not explode. And here's a picture of it taken on December the 9th. That's the inside of the turret.
And I'll put this picture up at hometownheroesradio.com. And I think some people who've been paying close attention are doing the math or following your drift on this, but go ahead and connect the dots for me from don't sit on two legs of a chair to the reason you're still here.
When the Arizona blew up, we didn't know it at the time. 1,177 men died instantly aboard that ship. You ever been out to Pearl?
Sure.
You've been aboard the memorial?
Yes.
You've seen the onyx wall, the plaque, with 1,177 names. But since then, there's been about, I would say, pretty close to 50 to 100 bodies put inside the ship.
Right.
So right after that explosion, I had my feet back up under. Right by my feet is a hatch, just big enough for a person to crawl through from one side to the other. It's locked down with four steel dogs. It blew that hatch right off those four steel dogs, that explosion. My footrest was just torn right off. If my feet had been out where they would be, I would have no legs, and I probably wouldn't be alive.
You wouldn't have made it off the ship.
No. Nobody would have known we were there because there was only the two of us in that right gun. And went right past my legs, underneath the elevating screw, past Crozen's legs, and landed against the barbette, picking both of us up simultaneously and throwing us 8 feet back into the elevating screw. Now, I had the JA phones on, and when I picked myself up off the deck, Crozen says, "Stu, let's get out of here." So I said, "A good idea," only he didn't say it quite that nice. And in order to get out, you got to go up a ladder to the primer deck. And when I got to the primer deck, I reached the end of the cord. And I grabbed a hold of the belt, snapped it in half, and threw the whole thing down in the pit. I spent 20 years trying to stretch one of those belts. Couldn't do it. And it wasn't until after I retired that I understood how it was possible. And I show the kids the Inquirer magazine that I had. And it says a mother lifted a one-ton car up off her son. And I said, "That's an impossibility." But I read the article, then I understood. The adrenaline flows right through your body when you're in a state of excitement. So anyhow, we got on a topside. Our ship was on about a 15-degree list. Mm-hmm. And you can see the Tennessee is on one inboard of us. Now, a shell that hit the number two turret on the Tennessee killed my captain. Captain Banyan came out of his battle station, walked around the flying bridge over to the starboard side when a shell hit the edge of number two turret. And a piece of that shrapnel flew up and went through the lookout tower and tore my vice president's leg wide open. He got the Purple Heart. I never earned a Purple Heart for the whole war and the Korean War. And I told Crozen when we got out of topside, I says, "If I don't get killed today, I'll live to see the end of this war." "How can you say that, Stu?" I said, "If you've got the faith to believe it, you can do it."
Stu Headley spent the rest of his life proving that, and we'll hear the rest of his Pearl Harbor story when this special edition of Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level. When prices start going up, we all look for ways to save. So here's a simple message for you. Look no further than EECU. Did you know you can finance your mortgage through EECU? How about a home equity line of credit? EECU makes HELOC loans easy. And when the car business is all over the map, the auto loan rates are as steady as can be. EECU is a not-for-profit credit union, not a bank. So the members always win. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today or call 1-800-5
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special edition in honor of the 83rd anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor. Let's pick up where we left off with Stu Headley from the USS West Virginia.
Well, while Crosin and I were watching the Oklahoma capsize, 12 minutes, Ensign Sears, a junior officer of our division, was screaming for us to get over on the Tennessee. And what he wanted us to do was to straddle the line and jimmy across. Well, while we were watching the Oklahoma go over, a plane zoomed in between the two ships and machine gunned all five of our buddies, and they just toppled in between the ship.
So they're on the line between the two ships.
Yeah.
And they get picked off like sitting ducks by these Japanese machine gun bullets.
Yep.
And I could see, as you described that, that the emotions are still stirred when you recall that.
Oh, yes. And I told Crosin, we're not going over any lines. How are we going to get over, Stu? I says, I don't know yet, but we'll find a way. As I was watching the Oklahoma capsize, we had 5-inch 38 anti-aircraft guns that stuck out over the side of the ship. Mm-hmm. So I said, Crosin, did you ever run down a railroad track? He said, what are you talking about? I says, did you ever walk on a well, when I was a kid, I said, you're going to do it today. What do you mean? I said, you see that gun barrel? We're going to go over in the Marine casemate starboard side, climb up on that gun barrel, run across it, and jump down in the Tennessee. The gun barrel is about that big around.
Yeah, a couple feet wide.
Five-inch. So he says, you go first. I says, okay. So I usually ask the kids, where do you think I was going when I hit the deck of the Tennessee? They don't have it. I says, I was going right back up into turret 3. That's my battle station. You talk about Pavlov's law. And I was on the third rung when a Marine lifted me off with his foot. Crosin was still coming down the deck. And he said, haven't you had enough of those turrets? What do you want us to do? Get over in the beach. I says, how? Swim, you idiot. And the fire, as you saw in that picture just a minute ago, this is the oil that's blazing on the water from the ships. Crosin and I went over on the starboard side of the Tennessee. Here's all these nice, neatly piled clothes and shiny shoes. So I said, Crosin, we're going to strip down to our shorts, undershorts, and we're going to jump in. We're not going to dive. I says, we don't want to hit our head on anything. And I said, go just as deep as you can and swim underwater. Well, I qualified as an ABC swimmer in boot camp, not an underwater swimmer. But I'll guarantee I swam underwater that morning or I wouldn't be here.
How far did you have to go?
I would say about twice the distance we are to that wall. Not too far, but with that burning oil, and like I say, I wasn't an underwater swimmer, I came up twice, and I thrashed like mad to get that oil and fire away. Hottest breath I ever breathed in my life. It's a wonder it didn't scorch my lungs. Twice we broke surface. The next time we were at the beach, and they took us right over to the dispensary and walked right across the deck, and it's a great big red cross. It's an open patio style with a deck all the way around with a railing, and we went up there. They examined us for any burns or any lacerations, any wounds of any kind. And they had tables and chairs and cots, a bed that they moved out, anything that they could put a body on. I was asked to speak out at UCSD, and this gal said, "Stuart, when you get to the point where you were at the dispensary, I want you to tell, you're going to be speaking to 85 doctors, surgeons, their admirals and generals, and I want you to tell them what your supplies were that morning." I says, "Kathy, you mean that?" I said, "They've got the finest of equipment and everything." "Yes." I said, "All right." So when I got to this point, they gave us a tube of unguentine ointment put on the burns. They gave us a jar of sulfa drug. That's to pour into the wounds and lacerations. Then they gave us morphine, cans of morphine, to minister to those that were dying or in dire pain. With those three items, we saved lives. Well, we were taking care of these fellows, and it's now about 9:25, and the second wave is coming in. And while we were taking care of these fellows, I looked up and I saw two planes approaching Fort Island. And I yelled, "Duck!" And we went under the benches, the tables, whatever we could. And glass just shattered all over the place. And one of the planes, when it lifted up, dropped a bomb right in the center of that patio. Now, 59 years later, on a Tiger cruise, the year 2000, we went over to Hawaii. And I told the fellas, "I want to go to that dispensary that I was in." So I walked right across the decking, walked up the stairs, and they're all dental offices across there now. I walked in, and these are corpsmen that are working with dentistry. And I said, 59 years ago, I was in this building. Those kids, what are you talking about? They didn't understand. They didn't know anything about the history of it. And I said, "Yes, 59 years ago, I was in this very building." Well, one of the dentists, who was a lieutenant commander, heard me. And he came over and he said, "Did I hear you right? You were in this building 59 years ago? That would have been December 7, 1941. I said, "Yes, sir." "Come here, I'll show you something." I had walked right across that decking, and I took a picture. These are the three fellows that were with me. And we stopped the car, and we took photographs of the bullet holes down the landing field.
That are still there.
Yep.
Yep.
And this is a picture where I walked across the decking, but when he took me back down, I took a picture of what he showed me. That's where the bomb hit.
They have one tile in the floor there now that says, has a bomb, and it says December 7th, 1941.
Yep.
But on that date, I mean, this is a tile that's there now memorializing that.
Great big red cross was painted across that deck so that from the air, you would know that it was a dispensary or a hospital.
But that's exactly where they hit.
That's where they hit.
It was X marks the spot.
You better believe it.
And what was the impact? What was the result of that bomb?
Well, dust flew all over everywhere, and I would say it was about 5 to 7, 8 minutes later that the dust cleared away. We looked over the banister. We didn't see a speck of red anywhere. Just literally tore that whole thing and turned it upside down.
The cross was gone.
Gone.
What about the patients that you guys had been treating?
They were still on the beds, but glass was all over them and everything. And there were about, I'd say, pretty close to 50 to 100 fellows that were helping. They grabbed everybody they could, even those that were on Fort Island or those that came in off the ships.
Like you guys.
Yeah. It's about 9:45. They told us, "You're needed back aboard ship to help fight fire." So they put us in a boat, took us back to our ship, and aboard the West Virginia, we had just gotten a new captain, Captain Benyon, and a new executive officer, Richard Hellencotter. And as soon as I got on the ship, the chief told me, Headley, you're going to handle the hose with the exec. He's going to handle the nozzle. You're going to hold the hose. When he cracked the hatch to the 3rd Division compartment, boom, boom. And I thought the Japanese are back, but it wasn't. The heat was so intense in the compartment that the moment he cracked that hatch and the air went in, it blew out our portholes. Mm. Took 45 minutes to cool that compartment down. And when we got it cooled down, I said, Commander, could I check my locker? He says, where's your locker, son? I said, right there in the corner. Go right ahead. I opened up my locker. There's my blues, my dungarees, my whites, my underclothes, my socks, a pair of shoes, my pea coat, a sweater, my hats, all stowed away just as neat as anything. But the minute I touched them, they turned to powder from the heat. And it was amazing because I opened up the drawer and the stupidest thing, instead of sending my photographs home with the negatives, that locker drawer was just one mass of goo. Everything was gone. So then I opened the bottom drawer, and I had a pearl buckle in there because I was making square knot belts out of Belfast cord.
Uh-huh.
And there was a half penny. Now, the story about the half penny goes back to October the 11th. The battleship Warspite, British battleship Warspite, came into port. They volunteered a group of us sailors to go over and mingle. And I was assigned to this British sailor. And he said, you know, he said, I don't have much that I could give you, but come on down to my locker and we'll see what I can find. So he took out this half penny and he said, I'll give you this. And he said, you know, you'll be in this war right alongside of us before long. I said, no. I said, we'll send you planes and tanks and ammunition. But and I thought to myself, what a prophecy when I saw that half penny.
Mm.
And I've still got that half penny. I drilled a hole through it and put a chain in it.
Oh, I'd love to see it. You know, you've described all this, and I know you've told your story hundreds of times, if not thousands of times. And I can't imagine how many lives have been impacted by your willingness to tell this story. But I'm struck by how much detail you remember. And the one thing I'm trying to figure out is how? How did you do all this? How did you manage to keep on going? And how terrified were you with this situation that nothing could have prepared you for?
Yes, there was a preparation. Because, see, we were out there a whole year before the attack. And we had battle drills, we had gun drills, we had man overboard drills. We had all kinds of drills that we were continuously practicing. So when the real thing happened, we're prepared and we do just what we're trained to do.
But
and
Stu,
you don't stop. And
but Stu, you saw bodies flying through the air. Then your body was blown back 8 feet. And you're holding your breath underwater because there's fire on the top. And you get to the beach. And when you get there, there's all these guys who are injured and maimed and dying. And you're treating them only to get bombed again where you're treating them. I mean, how can anything prepare you for that? And what
the
was
Lord.
It that, yeah, that was it.
The Lord prepared me for everything. He assured me, I will never leave you nor forsake you. I will be with you whatever you go through. That was where my faith was and my trust. That was all during the war. I went through 13 major engagements aboard the next ship, the San Francisco. The biggest battle we were in was Guadalcanal. Our ship was literally demolished. Eddie Huber and I were with damage control. We were electricians.
Mm-hmm.
We were assigned to go up and take over Gun 6. He was going to be the trainer. I was going to be the pointer. Gun 6 is the only gun that didn't get demolished. Gun 1, Gun 3, Gun 5, and 7 on the starboard side all took 14-inch shell hits. Gun 2, Gun 4, Gun 8 were wiped out. While we were on Gun 6, Gun 4 was destroyed. Joe Hubbard, who was our senior damage control officer, was walking on the deck behind us. When gun four got hit, a piece of the shrapnel of the blast shield took his head right off his shoulders.
Oh.
He walked about 8 steps and then collapsed and died. We had 75% of our officers killed in 45 minutes aboard that ship. The admiral was killed, the captain was killed, the executive officer was killed, the gun boss was killed, Joe Hubbard, damage control officer, he was killed. We had 236 died that night.
There's a million questions I'd love to ask you, but I think a real important one is, why do you tell your story? Why do you go to these different groups? What is it that you're hoping people will understand and remember?
Well, I'll put it this way. It relates to our motto. Remember Pearl Harbor. Keep America alert. America is asleep. It has been ever since the beginning of World War II.
Haunting words from Pearl Harbor survivor Stu Headley, who always wanted everyone to know what happened on that day of infamy so it wouldn't happen again. You can find dozens of interviews of Pearl Harbor survivors at hometownheroesradio.com. To the best of my knowledge, all but two of those we've interviewed on this program have passed away. Their stories and their commitment to preserving that history and extending that legacy are a powerful reflection of that truth we conclude with each and every week on Hometown Heroes. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.